Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, email, Google+, simple ways that you can share Issues Etc. programs with your friends, relatives, and fellow parishioners. Just go to Listen on Demand Archives at issuesetc.org and look for the share feature images posted beneath each audio segment. You're only one click away from telling someone about Issues Etc. The Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org and look for Share This.
It seems that our idea of religious freedom, religious liberty, is getting narrower and narrower with every passing decade, especially here in the United States. Of late, the theory is being bounced around that religious liberty is really not just freedom of religion or of conscience or of thought or of speech in the public square, that religious freedom really is only about freedom of worship. So as long as you're there on Sunday morning or whenever you worship, within the walls of wherever you worship, you can say, do, think anything you want. You can believe and say anything you want there in worship. But in the public square, other freedoms, well, all those freedoms that go along, conscience, speech, those need to be curtailed. They don't necessarily belong in the family of religious freedom or religious liberty out there in the public square. How central is the notion of religious liberty to all of the liberties that we enjoy? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. on this January 20th. It's Martin Luther King Jr. Day. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Oz Guinness joins us for the first hour. We're going to talk about religious freedom. A little bit later, in hour two, part eight of our series on the Formula of Concord, we'll be talking with Pastor Paul McCain, general editor of Concordia of the Lutheran Confessions, about the Lord's Supper. Oz Guinness is a regular guest. He's founder of the Trinity Forum, drafter of the Williamsburg Charter and the Global Charter of Conscience. He's author and editor of more than 25 books, including his latest titled The Global Public Square, Religious Freedom and the Making of a World Safe for Diversity. Oz, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks so much. Pleasure to be back.
We certainly have no dearth of problems regarding religious freedom or proposed solutions. Why do most of the solutions proposed to deal with religious freedom problems today, why are they unworkable?
Well, John, I would challenge the idea that we have so many solutions. I would say if you look at our Western world, we have masses of academic analyses, and we have a huge number of wonderful people who are monitoring persecution and oppression and things like that and raising the alarm. All that is terrific. Then, of course, in the culture warring, you have many people who are frantic or passionately concerned about the problems we're seeing. But what we lack, I would say, there are almost no solutions put forward. In fact, I would challenge you to say which ones you're talking about. There are almost no solutions, and that's why I wrote this book, to try and put forward a positive and a constructive vision of solutions, not just for the American experiment, but for the entire world one day. Solutions are lacking.
What do you mean by the term freedom of soul, and how does it differ from kind of the popular conception of freedom of religion?
Well, it's the same thing, but there's so many people just dismissing and discounting religious liberty as liberty for the religious and so on, that I've gone back to Roger Williams' wonderful term, soul liberty, or I call it soul freedom. And in the 17th century, this wonderful Christian dissident who later founded Rhode Island, as you know, he was the first to argue for freedom of conscience for everybody without exception. In other words, even heroes like John Milton, another strong Christian, limited it to Protestants and Catholics maybe, but not atheists. And John Locke, who for many is a hero of the Enlightenment, He left out both Catholics and atheists, but Williams said no, it was for everybody without exception. And it's that vision we need to recapture today, religious freedom, soul freedom for everybody, and work out what that means in a diverse society.
So is part of the problem, Oz, that, the average atheist, or ardent atheist in the United States, for instance, might say, well, you know, religious freedom is a great idea, but it's not anything that applies to me. I mean, I'm not religious. I have no particular metaphysical beliefs. And so while I certainly want to see somebody else have it, I don't need religious freedom. Is part of the problem there that it doesn't apply to people of all worldviews or seem to apply to people of all worldviews?
Well, that's the impression. And I think our atheist friends cheat at that point. In other words, they fail to recognize very often that atheism is itself a worldview. In other words, it's a naturalistic worldview rather than a supernatural worldview, but it's a worldview. And the Universal Declaration, and certainly all the European courts, got out of their way to point out it's freedom of religion and belief. And we've got to say that to it. Don't kid us. You have a worldview, too. In fact, I often say to atheists and debating with them and so on, listen, we know what you don't believe. You are theists. You don't believe in God, the gods, and the supernatural. But the real question is what you do believe in, a sort of atomism or whatever. And so, yes, we've got to tell atheists it is freedom of conscience without exception for everybody, including secularist worldviews. And we've got to work out how we live with that.
Now, is the primary problem the diversity of religious views in the public square? You even talk about the global square. What's the primary problem that we're trying to address here?
Well, if we look worldwide, we've got two massive problems. One is government oppression. Take, say, China or Iran. The other is sectarian violence. Take, say, countries like Pakistan or Nigeria with Boko Haram. Now, in the West, we don't face those problems, although we've got to stand for the victims of those sorts of oppression. But in the West, our problem is the culture warring. And you can see the traditional consensus in the West has broken down. It was largely Christian consensus. And the technical term is people say we've demonopolized or deterritorialized or deconfessionalized. In other words, the link between a country, you say Ireland, Catholic, but or say America, Protestant, and so on. That is gone. And we've seen an explosion of diversity and a sense of all the others in our society through immigration, through travel, and media. And it's now said that everyone is now everywhere. That's a little exaggerated, but there's never been such a scale of diversity, which is simply a social fact. So that's the underlying cause of the challenges. And with this incredible explosion of pluralism, how do we live with these deep differences, especially when they enter public life?
In the United States, there's a, you talked before about solutions. I can think of one, and it's, but I want your evaluation of it. It has to do with religious freedom and the current questions about contraception and primarily involving American Catholics and Catholic institutions. I'm sure you're familiar with the circumstances of healthcare legislation here. Well, the solution that is proposed, often on the side of those who just can't understand why Catholics wouldn't want to support something like contraception, is, look, you can have your freedom of worship. That is, you can believe, practice, say, restrict, and permit anything you want to on Sunday morning within the walls of your church or institutions, but not in the public square. The public square runs by different rules. There you got to play by there you have to forfeit some of that freedom. So they've proposed freedom of worship instead of freedom of religion. What's your evaluation there?
Well, that's not really a solution at all, because what it is a cutting down, a diminution of what freedom of conscience is. Freedom of worship is nothing. Every tyrant and dictator in history has guaranteed freedom of worship. In other words, what you believe between your two ears, so long as you keep your mouth shut, that you allow as freedom. But that's pathetic. I mean, the genius of the First Amendment back in 1791, was Madison's term, free exercise. And if you look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights today, it guarantees the adoption of a faith, it guarantees the exercise of a faith, it guarantees sharing a faith, the dreaded word proselytism, or what we call evangelism, and it guarantees a fourth thing, changing a faith, which, of course, is smack in the eye of the Muslim idea that if you convert from Islam, you know, that's worthy of the death sentence. So there are four things there that are much, much stronger than freedom of worship. And I would say freedom of worship, say the administration, Hillary Clinton and President Obama, the first 2 years, they started to talk like that. It wasn't really as a solution. It was actually out of ignorance. And as soon as you look at the history of the idea and what it really means, you realize that is no solution at all. It's a throwing away of the magnificent heritage of the American experience of freedom of conscience. We've got to reject that totally.
Let's talk about the history. Give us, I mean, we're talking about a large complex of ideas and peoples and places, but give us a brief history of the freedom of soul or the freedom of conscience.
Well, I mentioned Roger Williams, so let's just jump to the 18th century, of course, though behind Williams, and he was the first to talk about the separation of church and state, although he did so on behalf of the church, not on behalf of the state. But if you move to the founders here, you know, they're criticized for their attitudes, say, towards slavery or women or Native Americans, and they should be. Those were great blind spots. But I would argue they got religious freedom almost nearly perfectly right from the beginning. Now, of course, there was a huge discussion, and it was ideas such as Madison's free exercise, which eventually won the day. But you can see that when they separated church and state and disestablished religion, faith flourished, not despite disestablishment, but because of it, because faith was made voluntary and freedom of conscience was established as inviolable at the very heart of things. Now, there were troubles after that. You take, say, the nativist riots in Philadelphia, and sometimes the anti-Catholicism, sometimes the anti-Semitism. But America's had the most nearly perfect solution, and it didn't go the way of the French Revolution, which is much more secularist and a strict separation. But then the fateful year was 1947. And the Everson case, because that brought in a strict separation, not the original separation, which separated church and state, but not faith and public life. But strict separation tended to exclude religion from public life altogether. And that's fatefully different. And you can see that as secularists suppressed that, or strict separation has suppressed that, America's moved ever since the early 60s towards the French way of laïcité. And that's, of course, has created all the culture warring of this. So I think we've got to go back, understand the genius of what the framers did, and then work out what that means under the conditions of our explosive diversity today. But again, I'd say, Don, my sadness as an Englishman and European is that in the culture warring today, America's squandering its own incredible heritage. And at a time when the American way has lessons for the entire world, Americans undermined her own best way.
Oz Guinness is our guest. We're talking about religious freedom on this Monday, January the 20th. It's Martin Luther King Jr. Day. When we come back, Oz has mentioned several times the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. How did that document come about, and what recommends it as superior to other statements of religious freedom? We'll be right back.
Does your church need a backup organist? The virtual organist service from Church Music Solutions is the next best thing to an on-site organist. Send us your musical choices, including liturgy and hymns. We'll assemble your service and send it to an iPad that controls your church's organ on Sunday. The result is genuine organ leadership on your instrument with your selections when you need it. See our videos on YouTube or visit our website at churchmusicsolutions.com.
Did you know that we send out an email each week that details upcoming show topics? It's available for you to include in your weekly church bulletin. Just click the Issues Etc. Journal logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, and sign up to receive the church bulletin blurb. It's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen to Issues Etc. issuesetc.org. Look for the Issues Etc. Journal logo and register to receive a weekly bulletin paragraph from Issues Etc.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Here's Eric listening in Chicago. Hi, Eric. What's up?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say I really encourage people to give to Issues Etc. as it's the flagship of confessional liturgical Lutheranism in the world, I'd say, on the media.
Issues Etc. is listener-supported, and you can support the flagship of confessional liturgical Lutheranism in the media by making a secure online donation at our homepage, issuesetc.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.
Hey, St. Louis. How would you like to achieve your fitness goals in a fun and supportive atmosphere? Hi, this is Kevin Reisick, owner and operator of Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois. We offer adult boot camps throughout the week. These camps include cardiovascular conditioning, muscular strength and endurance training, balance and coordination activities, and more. For more information, give me a call at 618-670-6952, Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois, 618-670-6952.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking religious freedom with Oz Guinness, author of The Global Public Square, Religious Freedom and the Making of a World Safe for Diversity. Oz, before the break, and several times you've mentioned here the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. How did that document come about, and what is it about that that recommends it as a superior way of thinking about religious freedom in its fullest sense?
Well, Article 18 is the greatest article on religious freedom the world's ever seen. It actually goes beyond the first 16 words of the First Amendment, which guarantee sort of wonderful things like free exercise, but don't spell it out in quite the way that Article 18 does. And I said Article 18 has those four elements: coming to a faith, exercising a faith, sharing a faith, and changing a faith. And if you have all four of those for everybody and work out how you do that, then you have something absolutely incredible. So I was involved in the Global Charter of Conscience, which is not an attempt to pass something into law. We actually have some pretty good laws. But we need to reignite a debate about what religious freedom is and get beyond the culture warring. And so the Global Charter is to set out many of the things that even go beyond the Universal Declaration, spelling out what they mean. And we've got to think of these and debate them. And my sorrow is that Christians are not in the forefront of this, including American evangelicals.
Would you argue that the Universal Declaration is, in essence, what the American framers finally came up with but didn't make as explicit as does the Universal Declaration? Would you argue that that's essentially what they meant?
Yes, exactly. They went beyond it. I mean, the First Amendment went beyond and spelled it out what Roger Williams and others had intended. Because obviously, as the years went by, people saw some of the problems more clearly and some of the answers more clearly. And the same is true of the Universal Declaration. Of course, the leading architect of it was Charles Malik, who was a strong Catholic believer, as well as the Lebanese ambassador to the UN. So he was a wonderful Christian brother. I remember spending time with him in Washington before he died in the 80s. But it was quite clearly in his mind a confirmation, and in some ways a slight improvement, of the First Amendment and the whole tradition of religious freedom. So it was heavily influenced by Christians.
I want to come back to that. Let's talk a little bit about another term that we're operating with here, and that is the global public square. That is, as opposed to kind of the local public square or the national public square. How have we come to a global public square? I take it you're arguing, look, there's no turning back. We're not going back to the circumstances that gave birth to some of these conceptions of religious freedom.
Well, certainly the world's going forward. But as you know, the notion of the public square goes all the way back to Athens and the Agora. And that wasn't just the marketplace. You know, too many Christians talk about everything outside the home as the marketplace. Well, the marketplace is where things are bought and sold. That's business. But the Athenians also had a public square where citizens came together to deliberate and decide the issues of common public life. That's the public square. Now, originally, it was a physical place, the Agora in Athens, the Forum in Rome, the Westminster Houses of Parliament in Britain, or the French Assembly, or the American Congress in Capitol Hill, physical place. Then the word public square became not only a physical place, but a metaphor. In other words, the New York Times op-ed articles or a television program or whatever, wherever you discuss issues of common public life, that's the public square. It's much narrower than public life. Public life's much bigger. But now, here's the key thing. In the age of the internet and all the social media, the public square has gone virtual. So you take, say, the responses to the Danish cartoon controversies or to the Pope's speech at Regensburg. Today, if you say something, you can be heard by the whole world and the world can organize its response because of the age of the Internet. And so the notion of the public square is very rudimentary at the moment, but it's real. And we've got to figure out how to negotiate it. For example, you take, say, the blogs. Whenever you have, and we're talking about America here, not the rest of the world, whenever you have anonymous screen names in the blogs, you almost always see the type of debate descending to something that's really barbaric. People are degraded and dehumanized and so on. In other words, they're not debating as citizens should debate. And you can see the public square is in danger of arriving and degenerating at the same time.
Now, where should the debate take place? Where do you envision the debate about religious freedom occurring?
Well, it'll take place wherever citizens debate it, you know, in high school classrooms, op-ed pages, television programs, radio shows, and so on. But here's the point. Religious freedom shouldn't be debated forever. We've got to debate it to decide how we see it and then establish a civil public square. In other words, the rules of the game, how we negotiate, how we play our games, and so on. Well, that's got to be decided so that America goes forward civilly. Now, when that is decided, the rules of the game established, then you play the games. Then different faiths can enter and engage public life, debate all the things they like, but they're not challenging the ground rules. In other words, football or baseball or basketball would be chaos if in every game the players were challenging the rules. And that's what's happening with religious freedom at the moment. It's the ground rules that need to be reestablished. And that's what I try to do in my book, set out a vision of a constructive way forward on the ground rules, a vision for a civil public square.
So could the Universal Declaration of Human Rights be passed today in the U.S.?
Sadly, not in the U.S. and probably not anywhere in the world. But if you look at it very seriously, in 1948, part of the momentum towards it was the revulsion against all the things the Nazis had done, as well as somewhat lesser things in their minds, like the getting rid of imperialism and so on. And the West had an incredible moral authority, partly because they were the victors, and partly because morality was strong in the late 1940s in American and other forms of leadership. But today, you have, say, Islam powerful. In 1948, Saudi Arabia abstained, the only one to abstain from Article 18. Today, Saudi Arabia would oppose, and most of the Muslim bloc would join them in opposing notions that are there in Article 18. And, of course, today, China is strong. In 1948, you had the last tottering of Chiang Kai-shek's regime, which fell a year later. And the third thing, sadly, is America has lost both her leadership of the world in many areas, but also certainly lost any leadership in moral values and ideals. So in today's world, Article 18, and probably much of the rest of the Universal Declaration, simply couldn't be passed, which is why it makes it all the more urgent to get things right here and not to throw them away at the very heart of things.
If the U.S. has lost leadership in this idea, has someone else assumed leadership, in your opinion, or are we essentially leaderless on this?
No, we're basically leaderless. I mean, if you look at Europe really tried to follow these things, but it did so making a very simple but huge mistake. It thought that you could establish religious freedom by law alone. So Europe is heavy with articles, conventions, laws, you name it. But the gap between that and what Tocqueville called the habits of the heart, in other words, ordinary citizens' understanding of it, the gap between that is a huge chasm. And that's a European problem. Everything's done by law. And, of course, as you know, and you can see a bit of it over here too, when you resort to law only, you end up being litigious, and you have more and more laws and less freedom. And that's Europe's problem, and it's increasingly America's problem.
So it's not just – we talked about the cultural warring, but it's also the legal battles that sometimes even Christians and other religious sympathizers engage in enthusiastically – are counterproductive, ultimately, you're saying, only solution
absolutely.
Is law.
You're absolutely right. I mean, you go back to Tocqueville, and behind him was his great hero, Montesquieu. Montesquieu said you need not only the structures of freedom, that's law, you need the spirit of freedom, which Tocqueville, his disciple, later called the habits of the heart. In other words, parents pass it on to kids, teachers to their students, and it becomes a habit of the heart. That's the key to freedom, Tocqueville said. Well, here, Christians and Christian conservatives made a huge mistake. Liberal, I remember in 1986, I think it was, one of the leaders of the ACLU said to me, it's a simple reason we'll always win. We have more lawyers than everyone else. Well, today they don't. And now we have liberal lawyers, conservative lawyers, liberal defense funds, conservative defense funds, and endless litigation. Well, liberalism is still winning, not because they have more lawyers, but because if you resort only to law, you have litigation and less freedom. And that's a mistake conservatives have made. We need to reestablish what civility is, what freedom of conscience is, to regain the habits of the heart through civic education. Otherwise, we're just deepening the loss of freedom.
When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Oz Guinness, founder of the Trinity Forum and drafter of the Williamsburg Charter and the Global Charter of Conscience, talking about religious freedom. We're going to turn to one of the biggest problems when it comes to religious freedom globally, and that is the Islamic State. Stay tuned.
What happens when you take solid doctrine and solid curriculum and combine them with ancient scholars and modern technology? You get Wittenberg Academy, the very first completely online classical Lutheran high school. We are unabashedly Lutheran and offer families a rigorous standard of academic excellence. Students can pick and choose classes, or they can utilize our entire curriculum for their high school education. Visit our website, wittenbergacademy.org, to find out more.
There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/lcmsu.
Steadfast Lutherans, people who believe that traditional Lutheran preaching, liturgy, and hymnody continue to deliver Christ crucified for sinners today. The Reformation attempted to return the Church's focus on what we do for God back to a focus on what God does for us, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures. Some things never change. The gospel is still under attack from inside and outside the Church. To see how Lutheran doctrine and practice preserve the gospel, visit steadfastlutherans.org.
Apostles Lutheran Church is in Melrose Park, Illinois. We invite you to our divine service, which is held every Sunday at 9:15. Please contact us at 847-455-0903 or check out our website at apostlesmelrosepark.org. We are located just south of O'Hare Airport, where airplanes are continually going up. Here at Apostles, we glory in the one who on the cross was lifted up for the sins of the world.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The Church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century.
O come, O come, Emmanuel.
The 16th century.
Lord, keep us steadfast in your word. Help us to fight deceit.
The 21st century. The best of the Church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc. We're talking religious freedom with Oz Guinness. A little bit later, an hour or two, Pastor Paul McCain is going to join us. Part 8 of our series with him. We're doing it on the final document in the Book of Concord, the Lutheran Confessions, the Formula of Concord. And today, the subject will be the Lord's Supper. That's hour 2 of Issues, Etc. Oz, let's turn to something. We've mentioned already that the United States has ceded leadership on the issue of religious freedom. The European solution has been to kind of do this by law alone, as you say. Another wrinkle here, a big one globally, is the Islamic State and its conception of religious freedom, if you can even call it that. What are your thoughts there?
Well, I don't think they have a very powerful conception of religious freedom, to put it simply. But as I said at the beginning, you have two great problems in the world. One is sectarian violence. The other is government oppression. And in terms of government oppression, there are obviously two types. You have secularist governments, such as China or North Korea, and then you have religious governments, such as the Muslim ones in Iran or Saudi Arabia. And obviously, they do not accept freedom of conscience. And there's a great inconsistency behind many of their views. So when they put forward things like the Cairo Declaration, we should look at these very, very carefully, because there's a surface plausibility about these things that's undermined if you read the small print. So they talk about the rule of law and freedom within the rule of law, but actually they mean under the Sharia, Islamic law. And you can see at many points that Islam, when it's rigidly imposed, is one of the great enemies of freedom today, and especially freedom of conscience. Now, fortunately, wherever Muslims are in a Muslim minority situation, in other words, most of the Western world, many of them adapt well. And you have wonderful Muslim champions today of freedom of conscience. But of course, they're often physically in trouble, let alone other ways, in their own communities. So Islam is one of the great challenges. Can they come to accept freedom of conscience? Well, in the early 19th century, the Catholics were the great opponents of it, including the Pope at the times. And over 150 years, they've switched from being against freedom of conscience to being some of the greatest champions of it around the world. And the hope is that eventually that will happen to Islam too, particularly under the impact of modernity.
Wouldn't that mean, in effect, though, not to get too far afield from our subject, but wouldn't that mean that the Islamic State as we know it today would cease to exist if they were to switch on these ideas?
Well, the Islamic State, as we know it today, as you put it, is actually under threat anyway. Or put it differently, modernity is the greatest solvent of close societies in history. So it's already brought down the Soviet Union. In my field, it was said that when Raisa Gorbachev was seen using the American Express card, the days of the Soviet Union were numbered, and that's what happened. And the same is true slowly in China. Information technology and free market capitalism are loosening slowly but surely the iron grip of communism. Well, I think communism is actually weaker than Islam. But you can see the same thing beginning even in countries like, say, Iran. There was a time in which the most popular television and program in Iran was, believe it or not, Baywatch. In other words, modernity, with its freedom through technology and other things, is an acid that's corroding that. And I think it'll only be a matter of years before what you call the Islamic State as we know it today will collapse in one way or another.
You mentioned China, something you have personal experience with. Do you see a time in the nearer future when countries like China, or China in particular, will begin to loosen, perhaps even adopt a more robust idea of religious freedom?
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, you can see it happening very, very slowly. For example, I was at a seminar in China a few years ago where they said, which faith will replace Marxism in China? In other words, they said the party is in power, the ideology is dead. And they literally raised the question, would it be materialism, nationalism, Confucianism, Buddhism, or could it be the Christian faith? And the president recently has said, we need the help of some, he only restricted it to the Chinese faith, such as Confucianism, Buddhism. We need their help in maintaining ethics. In other words, the loosening power of communist and its grip is going. And that's very important to watch.
Once that goes, let's say, for instance, they say, grant more freedom, China would grant more freedom to for lack of a better word, indigenous religions like Confucianism or historic religions, is that pretty much the first crack in the dike at that point? Are they on their way to understanding religious freedom in its broader sense?
Absolutely, because as you know, the traditional religions couldn't do what they want to be done. And as you also know, the church is exploding in China. There are more Christians in China than there are Communist Party members. So eventually, that's to say, not just our Chinese traditional faiths, but the Christian faith. And many people see that in 20 years' time, if things go on, the Christian faith could be the majority faith in China, with tremendous consequences, not just for China, but for the entire world. Of course, there's a sting in the tail there, because you can see modernity undermines the Christian faith. Look at the sorry mess of the churches in much of the West. So the growing church in China will have to have a form of discipleship that prevails over the challenges of modernity, and that's a huge question.
Is part of the problem here, back to the U.S. context, that we have come to view religious freedom or soul freedom, as you call it, as only one freedom among many, not a sine qua non of all other freedoms?
Well, you put it well, Todd. We have to ask where it fits in. It's always understood there are three basic political freedoms: freedom of conscience, freedom of speech, and freedom of assembly or association. And there's no hierarchy, but they're all interlocked, and obviously conscience is the deepest. In other words, you want to get together with people, freedom of assembly, not just to have a hug-in, but to say something, freedom of speech. And freedom of speech assumes and requires freedom of conscience. The speech you want to say is not about the weather, but about things that really matter to you because you're convinced of them based on the dictates of conscience. So conscience is the deepest. And we've got to have a debate in America which puts these things back into perspective. For instance, a notorious example of the problem is the way gay activists, or some of them, to be fair, not all, gay activists are using gay rights to trump religious freedom. Well, the gay rights, which certain states, say New York on marriage, gay rights are a civic right, civil right. In other words, the state of New York has deemed it right to accept, say, same-sex marriage. Human rights are different. They are rights because they're inherent in humanity, not just because New York says we'll allow these. So a human right should never be trumped by a civic right. And yet that sort of confusion goes on. So we need to reassess the whole notion of rights and responsibilities, not entitlements, and really think through what these means and get it right. America's in great confusion today.
So you're really talking here about a confusion over what it means to be human, aren't you?
Absolutely. And that underlies everything. In other words, you've got three basic notions: human dignity, individual liberty, and personal responsibility. Those three are vital to open, free societies, and they're all in chaos. So you mentioned human dignity. When I was a student many, many years ago, all the humanists I knew would have been in favor of human dignity. Then came the arguments from philosophers like John Gray. When humanists support human dignity, they're actually believing something that's parasitic on the Jewish and Christian faiths, which believe people have dignity because they're made in the image of God, and we don't believe that. So now you see, say, Steven Pinker, the stupidity of dignity, the uselessness of dignity. Or you have Sam Harris, the illusion of freedom. So some of the deepest things like human dignity and human freedom are undermined in the current discussion by some of our atheist friends. And so we see a very, very profound degeneration and controversy, which will inevitably affect our free societies. We're in trouble.
Can we get humanists, if there are any left, naturalists, atheists, those who would regard themselves of no faith perhaps, can we get them to understand and support a notion of human dignity, intrinsic human dignity, even though their philosophies, if consistently applied, would not accept it?
No, they will go. And if they're our leaders and they affect culture disproportionately, you will see all sorts of consequences like this, as we're doing, say, with the euthanasia and other things like that. No, it's very, very consequential. So we are at the moment what's called a cut flower civilization. You know, I tell the story in the book of talking to a Chinese scholar who said to me, "What am I missing? We in China are fascinated with the Christian roots of your Western past for the sake of China's future. In other words, what's behind capitalism, the universities, et cetera, et cetera." He says, "But you in the West are cutting off your roots. What am I missing?" And the answer, of course, he was missing nothing. We're a cut flower civilization. The deepest, we owe a lot to the Greeks and the Romans, the deepest roots of the West are Jewish and Christian. And they're the roots that are being cut off, and there will be consequences. We're somewhere between the lightning and the thunder. But believe me, that the thunder will come, and the consequences will flow from the choices that this generation is making. We've been talking about religious freedom, but the problem goes across the whole board.
You're listening to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Oz Guinness is our guest. We're talking religious freedom. When we come back, he spoke of consequences. Well, what are the consequences if we continue going the way we are when it comes to the freedom of the soul? We'll be right back. Stay tuned.
South Africa,
China,
Germany,
Trinidad and Tobago.
Did you know that people listen to Issues Etc. around the world? India,
Sweden,
Egypt,
France,
Turkey,
Japan,
Australia,
Canada,
United Kingdom,
Hong Kong, Austria,
Finland,
Malaysia,
Singapore,
Bulgaria,
Korea,
Brazil.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Help us proclaim Christ to the world.
The Philippines,
Mexico,
Spain,
New Zealand,
Kuwait.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Our Savior Lutheran, Westminster, Massachusetts. Redeemer Lutheran, Fairhope, Alabama. St. Matthew Lutheran, Stony Plain, Alberta, Canada. Holy Cross Lutheran, Moline, Illinois. St. Paul Lutheran, Munster, Indiana. St. John Lutheran, Racine, Wisconsin. Calvary Lutheran, Baltimore, Maryland. Reformation Lutheran, Afton, Missouri. Emmanuel Lutheran, Lima, Ohio. Risen Lord Lutheran, Taylorsville, Kentucky. Prince of Peace Lutheran, Crystal Lake, Illinois. And Trinity Lutheran, Elmore, Ohio. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click support, and print the one-page flyer. When your congregation becomes a congregational sponsor, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal, the Issues Etc. 300. The book of Job is difficult to understand. There's no two ways about it. It's really exciting at the beginning, and then it has about 39 chapters of really boring stuff if you read through it. Conversation, long conversation between Job and his so-called friends. And then God gets to speak near the end, and it's all over with. In the blink of an eye, and Job is right back where he was, double repaid for everything that God had taken away from him. Now, did God take it away, or did Satan take it away? That's one of the questions that I deal with in my latest Issues Etc. journal article called Job in Four Not-So-Easy Steps, talking about the book of Job in terms of Christ and his suffering, not just Job and his. Also in the latest Issues Etc. journal, the Wittenberg Trail feature written by Ross Johnson, Lutheranism, Christianity's Best Kept Secret. You can read both of these absolutely free when you subscribe to the Issues Etc. journal. Go to our website, issuesetc.org. There's a big red button. Click on that. You'll enter your email address, and then you're subscribed to the latest Issues Etc. Journal, issuesetc.org. Look for the big red button. We're talking about religious freedom. Oz Guinness is our guest, founder of the Trinity Forum, drafter of the Williamsburg Charter and the Global Charter of Conscience. He's author and editor of more than 25 books, including his latest, The Global Public Square, Religious Freedom and the Making of a World Safe for Diversity. Oz, you talked about consequences. What do you think the consequences are? What do you see those consequences being if we continue the direction we're going, answering the question of the freedom of the soul?
Well, we talk mainly about religious freedom. And if it goes on like this, you're seeing a mounting clash between conservatives and Christian people who'd like to restore the previous consensus, but they're largely failing. And you can see from the moral majority to the Christian coalition to the Tea Party members, that whole approach is failing, and not just failing, it's creating a backlash against the unwisdom in which they fought many of the battles, which means, sadly, that the other side, the secularists, the separationists, people who like to exclude religion from public life, are largely winning. And so as the culture wars go on, since they represent most of the elite in our country, we'll see moving in that direction, which will lead to all sorts of consequences. For example, the growing coarsening of our culture. You see, I mean, something trivial like, say, little Miley Cyrus or something like that. It just goes on in 100 areas, worse and worse. And I just opened Christianity Today, the magazine, last night, and there's a Christian college saying that for 6 months it will allow its professors to have same-sex marriage in their practice, or at least same-sex partnerships in their practice. Now, the next article was, the next little news piece was about another Christian college in which the president of the student body was an atheist and elected in as an atheist of this Christian student body. And you can just go on every single day. There's a straw in the wind here, straw in the wind there, straw in the wind somewhere else. The straws in the wind are now a haystack. And many people don't see that the frog is slowly boiling alive in the kettle.
Do we also need to understand that this is ultimately, I mean, in terms of the broader swath of history, really not a question of degrees, but a question of either getting this right or the consequences that you've described here. We do have to get this right, this notion of freedom of soul, sooner or later. Otherwise, we will lose it altogether.
Absolutely. We'll not only lose soul freedom, but we'll lose so many of the things that grow out of religion being powerful in public life and in private life. Let me remind you of something that absolutely made me stand still when I first read it. It's Lord James Bryce, who's second only to Tocqueville as a European commentator on America. He was Queen Victoria's ambassador at the end of the 19th century. And he pointed out there was a simple reason why things would, if they did start to degenerate in America, would degenerate fast. In other words, America had much more strength of morals and so on than European countries then. But Europe always had first tradition and then relatively tight social cohesion. People lived together in villages and so on. And that held things together. But he pointed out that in America, there was such freedom and such mobility that the only thing that kept America together with social cohesion was faith, religion. So if religion went, he said, America would experience, I'm quoting now, the completest, never seen that word used anywhere else, the completest revolution of all. In other words, there'd be incredibly rapid degeneration because it's faith that's holding things together when not much else does in this country. And you can see that unraveling going on apace today.
So that's why the Global Charter of Conscience will talk about freedom of soul along with political freedoms, other social freedoms that we enjoy.
Absolutely. Now, I was in Congress a few years back talking to a group, and one of them put his hand up at the end and said, you know, there's a flood. A small boy can put his finger on the dike and will be called a hero. But here from Capitol Hill, I'm looking at in America, there's not a flood, there's a mudslide. What can anyone do? And you can see in many ways, I use the word cut flower or unraveling. You can see in many ways that notion of mudslide. Everything's linked to everything, and no one law or political initiative or whatever can solve it. And it will take a really genuine, massive revival and restoration of the integrity and power of faith to put many of these things right, which, put simplistically, only the Lord can solve and not us. Now, that's true, of course. I shouldn't have said simplistically. I meant simply, only the Lord can do. So no amount of human initiatives or action can put some of these things together. There's a mudslide, and only God can reverse it.
What does the Global Charter of Conscience mean when it talks about dignity of difference?
Well, it argues what I call the freedom to be faithful. In other words, some people think that if we give everyone religious freedom, we'll have just a big mishmash in which no one believes anything, and people will search for a lowest common denominator and pretend we've got that, like, say, Karen Armstrong's notion of universal compassion or whatever, or the liberal notions of ecumenism. No. Freedom of conscience means that each person, each community, is free to be faithful to its own faith. I used the word earlier, ground rules for the games. In other words, I call it the Queensbury rules. Boxing was brutal. But when the Marquess of Queensbury allowed his name to be put forward to the rules, boxing was put in a ring, under a referee, within rules. So you touch gloves, you don't punch below the belt, or you're disqualified, but you still fight. And that's freedom of conscience in public life. In other words, Christians are never called to say the atheists are right, or Jews or Muslims or Hindus are right. No, we believe in the Christian faith. They believe in their faiths. But within the ground rules of freedom of conscience, we know how to debate with other people civilly, in other words, in a tough, robust way, but peacefully. And that's very important. It's the freedom to be faithful. There is a dignity in respecting the rights of all the differences.
Why is the radical ecumenism, maybe even kind of the kind of blurring of lines between religions in the public square, even in terms of prayer and worship, why is that not a solution here, Oz?
Well, take it theologically first, Todd. I mean, you have liberals, or say, take the National Cathedral here in Washington. They call it a house of prayer for all people. Well, that goes back to Isaiah. But the liberal notion behind the current dean is that no religion today is absolutely, exclusively true. So they all have a bit of the truth so we can all worship together in the National Cathedral. That is not what Isaiah was talking about. In Isaiah, there is one God, there is no one beside the other gods, they're all idols and nothings. And that is why, since the others are nothing, the temple, the house of God, could be the house of prayer for all nations. In other words, the universal embrace of Isaiah was based on the fact of truth, not the modern relativism that's behind, say, the National Cathedral today. So we're in a very, very different situation, and Christians have got to engage with these things in a tough-minded way and take them on, or the relativism will lead further and further and further, you know, into the church, into evangelicalism itself, and that obviously what happened in that Christian college that I mentioned.
Then with only about 30 seconds, how would you respond to someone who says, Oz, great ideas, but it's a utopia you're talking about here. What's your response with about 30 seconds?
Yeah, my response would be, these things are urgently necessary, or else we will reap the consequences of our bad choices. So yes, it's a solution beyond where we are now. If we're content with where we are now, ignore the solution. If we're not content, think seriously, and think seriously about going this way.
Oz Guinness is founder of the Trinity Forum, drafter of the Williamsburg Charter and the Global Charter of Conscience. He's author and editor of more than 25 books, including his latest, The Global Public Square, Religious Freedom and the Making of a World Safe for Diversity. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Oz, thank you for your time.
Always great to be with you, Todd. Thanks.
Folks, if you appreciate Issues Etc., talk radio for the thinking Christian, please consider joining our monthly or annual giving program, the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. Membership benefits include items like t-shirts, books, broadcast transcripts, and advertising for your congregation. You can find out more about the Issues Etc. Reformation Club at our homepage, issuesetc.org. Look for the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses. When we come back on this Monday afternoon, January the 20th, Pastor Paul McCain joins us. We've been in a long conversation with him on the last document in the historic Lutheran Confessions, the Formula of Concord. We're going to turn to the subject of the Lord's Supper when we come back. It's one of the longer articles in that document. We'll find out why with Pastor Paul McCain, general editor of Concordia of the Lutheran Confessions, right after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
We now have 7 Spanish language transcripts of Issues Etc. that you can download for free.
Ahora tenemos 7 transcripciones en español de Issues Etc. que se puede descargar gratis.
These broadcast transcripts cover the 6 chief parts of Luther's Small Catechism and include a teaching on why do bad things happen.
Estas transcripciones cubren las 6 partes principales del Catecismo Pequeño de Lutero e incluyen una enseñanza que se llama ¿Por qué pasan las malas cosas?
Guests include Matt Harrison, Peter Bender, and Carl Fickenscher.
Los invitados incluyen Matt Harrison, Peter Bender, y Carl Fickenscher.
You can download and print these Spanish transcripts for free. Just go to issuesetc.org and click Publications.
Se puede descargar e imprimir estas transcripciones en español gratis. Solo vaya a issuesetc.org y haz clic en publicaciones.
The grace of God, the church's music, the Lord's Supper, every service, every Sunday, and Wednesdays too, preaching Christ crucified and risen. There is hope in St. Louis, Hope Lutheran Church, that is, 5218 Neosho Street, St. Louis, Missouri, or find us on the web at hopelutheranstl.org.
The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January only costs $7.99. It's titled, 5 Things You Can Do to Witness Christ. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase 5 Things You Can Do to Witness Christ by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, equipping you to witness Christ on the front lines, 5 Things You Can Do to Witness Christ.